Hello and welcome to the podcast of the Organization and Management Theory Division of the Academy of Management. I am your host, Tanya Olsen, and in this series of podcasts, we are going to talk to scholars from the OMT division to find out more about them, their research, and their motivations for doing the work that they are doing. Our guest today is Mark David Seidel. He's a professor at the UBC Sauder School of Business in Vancouver, Canada. His work is in the field of entrepreneurship and innovation, with a focus on technology and new forms of organizing and working. He's also a former division chair for the OMT division. In our conversation for this podcast, he told me about his hobby of stand-up comedy and how that connects to his work. I hope you enjoy hearing more about the career and work of this wonderful researcher. Mark David Seidel, welcome to the OMT podcast. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks for having me.
I would like to talk to you about your career and about your role in the OMT group, but in the preparation for this podcast, I read something about you that I would like to start out with for the first few minutes. I read that your hobby is improv theater. I was wondering, does that help you at all in your job, especially in the classroom?
Well, when I got started doing improv many years ago, it was more as a procrastination from my regular job as an assistant professor. And then as I started doing it, I unfortunately realized that it overlapped with the career quite a bit as well. So it actually helps think creatively, work in teams, and actually helps with teaching quite a bit as well.
What have you learned from improv that you can use in your teaching?
The most, probably the biggest point from it is being present in the moment. This was well before the mindfulness movement became buzzwordy. And it's basically just listening actively and responding to the people around you in a positive way and then building on their ideas instead of ripping them down.
For any young scholars, I know a lot of people, when they start out in their careers, they have a hard time managing a classroom and managing especially a large MBA class. Do you have any quick advice, anything you have learned over the years that they can use?
Probably the biggest bit of advice I learned from an excellent case instructor that ran one of those case instructor workshops, where he said his trick was to create conflict. And that sounds backwards to a certain extent, but in essence, as he explained it, the majority of students, when you're discussing any sort of an issue, come down somewhere neutral or slightly left or slightly right of whatever the spectrum is on the question that you're asking. And then if you push them to the extremes on it a little bit to create a little bit of tension and get them engaged with debating each other around both sides of an issue, the discussion flows much more naturally. You as an instructor become much less important, and they start to actually think critically about whatever the core idea is. That works for teaching as well as around research or developing papers.
Huh. So are you saying that in a paper, the more controversial you are, the better the paper is?
In essence, there has to be a tension in a paper. So some people will call it a puzzle, a theoretical puzzle, or something such as that. But in essence, you're interacting with the entire field of established literature and finding something that needs to change in it if it's a good theoretical paper that's making a contribution. So finding what that is and then highlighting how you are advancing the field through changing something actually creates a much more interesting paper.
Yeah, I can see that. Do you have any advice on how you can create that conflict in a paper, or how you can highlight that or find even that puzzle?
The biggest one is finding assumptions in the existing theories that are wrong. It is a good starting point. So if you take a theory that seems relevant, and then if you interrogate the underlying assumptions of that theory, and then just see if the assumptions get violated in a particular context. And when they get violated in a particular context, that's where you're likely to find a theoretical advance.
Oh, okay. I can definitely understand that. I can see that.
your career has been quite extensive. And something else that I learned about you in the preparation is that you first started your research in your PhD in work in the airline industry. And that's not something that I would naturally associate with you and with your work right now. Can you give me a bit of an overview how you got from the airline industry to the work that you're doing now?
Yeah, so I was always interested in travel. This was well before graduate school. And I also had an interest in technology well before graduate school. I worked in internet protocol development and developing pre-web internet sites back in the 80s, before Al Gore invented the internet. And in essence, when I was in graduate school, because of the travel interest, I studied the airline industry. And then while I was procrastinating on my dissertation during, I believe, my third year, that classic period where doctoral students basically kill time procrastinating, the web came out. So Netscape launched, HTML came about. And at that point in time, I realized this is something that might actually bring technology, a very useful technology, out to the general public instead of just for techies, which was the thing that we always struggled with when I was working in that space before. And what ended up happening is I accidentally, while I was procrastinating, started the first airline website before the airlines had websites.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So what ended up happening is then the internet commercialized. And one thing led to another. I was in the Bay Area, not too far from the core of Silicon Valley. And it ended up turning into a venture while I was in graduate school. And so got very heavily involved in the tech space through that and doing that entire rise of building out the first travel websites and the entire web community that evolved around travel and watching that transition from a free information system to a commercialized internet. And that sociologically was extremely interesting to me. So it was always kind of an underlying research question that I keep revisiting in various ways over the years. And now, as I've gotten a little bit older, have been able to get more involved in it more directly.
Okay. What made you decide to go into academia? It sounds like in the Bay Area, in tech, in that time, you were in the perfect space to have the next unicorn.
Well, it didn't say we didn't have a unicorn. that company actually did go public, and we eventually sold it. So that did go well. But that's...
Congratulations.
Well, no. That said, the decision to stay in academia, because I was already in academia when I started that, I didn't start that with any sort of an intent, as you see many student groups now talking about exit events prior to even starting something. It was really just out of natural curiosity and learning how to use the technology. And in essence, the decision for academia happened earlier than that. It was when I decided to go to graduate school. Because back then, as I mentioned, I had been working with the early internet, the non-web-based internet, and this was still relatively unknown outside of any sort of very technical circles. And when I was graduating from my MBA program, I applied simultaneously to jobs, so basically typical MBA jobs, as well as graduate school, because it was a very difficult academic and job market year broadly. And what ended up happening is I got offers from graduate schools as well as an offer on Wall Street to head a division of a major financial services firm to figure out what to do with this new thing called the internet, because they had heard about it and they thought it might be important in the future for financial news and information. And what ended up happening is I met the individuals I would be working with there, and I also met all the people at the graduate schools that I would be studying at. And the people that I met on Wall Street had no interest in the technology whatsoever. They cared more about who I knew. And the people in academia cared nothing about who you knew, and they basically cared about ideas and debating the ideas. And that was a lot more interesting to me. So I got drawn in that direction and turned down the Wall Street job to head the internet division of a major financial services firm as a person of one.
Wow, nice. Is the draw still the same for you? Are you still drawn by the ideas, by the conversations? And is that what makes you attracted to academia, or is it more the people, or is it a combination now?
Yeah, so for me, academia is this ideal job where you get paid to think about things that you're interested in and to work with smart people around those problems as you discover them. And you can find those types of things in the commercial world at times, but there's nothing like academia for the academic freedom of being able to really think about whatever topic you want. And that's just, it's a lovely freedom that sometimes is lost when people are working through the career and, you know, get captured by some of the instrumental aspects of the career. But it is the core aspect of it. And if you talk to a lot of academics, particularly ones that have been around a little bit longer, they were drawn to it originally for that freedom in one way or another, and are dismayed by some of the instrumental components that we see coming out at times.
Yeah. So I know you're still working in tech and in the latest technologies, blockchain, for example, and cryptocurrencies. Is tech still a major interest of you? And what are the research questions that you're addressing now?
Yeah, so I've been broadly interested in this area of distributed trust. And blockchain is one example of this distributed trust, but it's just an early example. It's likely not going to be the technology that is sustained in that space. But the core idea there of, if you think back to the internet, what the internet did to a large extent at first, when it first commercialized, it basically brought old business models online, such as mail order catalogs. That was the first wave of internet companies that did commercial activity. So you could basically look at a mail order catalog, click on an item, and they would ship it to you, just like calling into the Sears catalog. The second wave is where we started seeing these platform technologies, where basically the social media came about, where people started creating the content, the users started creating the content, and then the organizations themselves became basically platform organizations. So Facebook became, you know, a matching of your personal data with advertisers' needs. Google does the same. And they basically are platforms just to match. Now this next wave is where trust can actually be distributed as well, the same way that content creation was distributed by the last version of the web that came about. And now you no longer need those centralized institutions for that trust function. That's the research question from an organizational theory perspective that I'm fascinated by, because the majority of the Silicon Valley success stories that you look at are platform organizations that make their money and their profit by generating third-party trust and vouching for a transaction in one way or another. Societally, we see them breaking that trust and breaching that trust regularly now. So the users are starting to become suspicious of them. And now there's a technology that solves that, where you no longer, in theory, will need those third parties to enter into a trusted relationship with a stranger. Now, as that technology evolves, that means what we see as large centralized organizations become much less important. And that's kind of a core principle of organization theory, is that organizations come about to centralize activity and to provide reliability and trustworthiness. And that's no longer necessary. So the way we think about organizations has to shift to more of kind of an ecosystem model, where an individual organization is just a value add to a particular network of transactions that's much more broad than a single platform.
Okay, so does that mean that we don't trust institutions anymore, but we trust each other more?
Well, it's actually trusting the technology rather than trusting each other. And that's where it gets kind of dicey, because the technology is not trustworthy yet, but it's marketed as such. But at some point, it will become to the point where people just take it for granted that the technology has validated a transaction with someone else, be it a social transaction, be it a monetary transaction, whatever it may be. And you'll no longer require the bank to say, yes, there's money in that account. The money will just transfer if there's a monetary transaction. You'll no longer require Twitter to put a little check mark saying it's an authenticated user, because that will be embedded with that person's identity, where it's authenticated by the broad net without a single organization having that authority. And that's where it gets interesting, because it challenges a lot of the assumptions around institutions.
Yes, because at the moment, we trust the institutions to do these checks for us. But does it really mean that institutions will become obsolete? There are still institutions needed, maybe Facebook and or Google and the hordes of programmers there that program these algorithms, because the technology needs to be created and there needs to be some kind of mechanism for us to be able to trust into the technology.
Yeah, so this is a gradual transition that's going to occur over time. But if I put the question to you of which institution owns the internet?
Well, none really.
Exactly. And it's the same thing. So we take it for granted that, you know, we're speaking on a podcast right now. And once we overcome any technical issues, we basically have a decent connection that's being routed most likely by multiple commercial entities. You know, there's an ISP involved on both ends of this. There's something in between that's doing the bandwidth. There might be a cable running under an ocean or whatever it is. These are all individual commercial entities, but we're not using, quote, the internet company. And in that future distributed trust world, you can engage in that. So the same way that we're having a communication content going over this shared public infrastructure, the trust can go over that shared public infrastructure as well. So imagine if this podcasting software that we're using right now also had reputation ratings built right into it that weren't controlled by a third party.
So is reputation really the currency of the future?
Reputation is one of the currencies. So reputation around all the informational content. And then, of course, there's still going to be some sort of economic value being transacted in the world for many years. And that economic transaction, if you think about it, one of the examples that I like to use is if you think about the ride hailing industry. So if you take like a Lyft or an Uber or an Ola or one of those, currently there's this platform organization that matches riders with drivers. And that match, they take 35 to 40% of the value that's generated for that matching without actually providing much value other than saying your driver is safe or the rider is safe. And then doing a little bit of monetary transaction to shift some funds. But the actual value producers in that transaction, it's the driver is the one producing the bulk of it. And in terms of the economic movement, the rider is paying for it. And so in theory, all you would need is information on, is that a reputable driver? Is it a reputable passenger? So that they're both comfortable with it. And then the economic transaction can just move seamlessly. And then there's no need for that middleman anymore. And that middleman trust institution, which is an organization like Uber or Lyft, they disappear from that entire framework.
Yeah, that almost sounds like, and I know this is a big question, but that sounds like the big question now is, are we all getting more connected through technology?
It's a very good question. And the important aspect of it, and this is what we've been trying to do here with the activities that we've set up at UBC, is a lot of this technology is being developed by technically oriented individuals. Not all of them necessarily have a deep understanding of organizational theory or sociology or public policy and these types of things. And the technical choices they're making and how the technology is designed have drastic implications for all of those. And it's very important to get people involved who understand the social sciences, politics, public policy, sociology, psychology, all of these aspects need to be involved in the design of the technology so that we don't end up with a very dangerous outcome.
Yeah, I see that. That means that in order for practical implications to be managed, it sounds like your research and all of our research really needs to be a lot more interconnected with different researchers from different fields.
Yeah, and that it's a very valid point. And that's actually a core driving aspect of this initiative that you may have heard of called RRBM, the Responsible Research and Business Management, which is an association of faculty across all the fields of business globally that are concerned about how to make our research actually answer societal problems and satisfy societal challenges. And that is part of a larger initiative that's outside of just the business school called the HIBAR Alliance, which actually started here at UBC, and I've been actively involved with that as well. And that's how to drive all of academia towards that more responsible, societally inspired research that still advances the basic science, but also addresses questions that matter for society.
That sounds like you're involved in a lot of different initiatives and groups, and it's a perfect segue for me to ask you a bit more about the OMT group that you have been involved with for a number of years now. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you do within OMT and what your role is there?
Sure. So my early involvement with OMT started just as a member. Then in the early 2000s, I served in a three-year position called a representative at large. Those are the people who organize things like the Junior Faculty Consortia, which is what I was responsible for organizing when I did that role. Some of the other three-year reps would do the Doctoral Consortia, for instance. Others do our global data types of initiatives. I did that for 3 years, and then I took a bit of a break from the executive role and then joined again in a five-year leadership position, which basically is it's called the division chair sequence. And one of the years you take care of the PDW program, another year you take care of the academic program, you then eventually become the division chair, which I was last year, and then the year that I'm just wrapping up now is the illustrious title of past division chair, which is basically institutional memory. And I'll be stepping down, you know, the end of my five-year term is this August at the Academy. But basically, you know, the OMT division is a unique division from the Academy because it crosses a lot of boundaries, a lot more so than some of the other more specialized divisions. So it's reasonably large, you know, a little bit over 4,000 members, and they come from a wide variety of fields. So there are people who cross over to almost every other division from the Academy. And what we do at OMT is try to make it the place for people to come together and actually learn from those interdisciplinary perspectives.
What have you enjoyed most about your time in this five-year position, or at OMT in general, really?
For me, the aspect of OMT that makes it distinctive is it's really an academic home for me. So the colleagues that I've met over the years through OMT and continue to meet each year are some of the most supportive and developmental colleagues I've seen in academia, particularly in business schools. And it's just a wonderful community of people that basically have a focus on developing a new entrance to the field, welcoming newcomers to the division, and encouraging them to develop their own voice and figure out how they can actually answer important questions.
I assume that you were at the Academy last year, and I assume that you will go this year again. What stood out from your last visit at the conference? And what do you like best about going to the Academy?
So it's kind of a loaded question, because when you're in the five-year role, you don't get to actually experience the conference. You're putting on the conference. So last year at Academy, I was actually division chair, which meant that I was running around like crazy and not able to participate as an actual active participant. It was more making sure everybody else was able to do that. But if I look over the 5 years and more broadly, one of the initiatives that we started while I was involved with the leadership that I'm probably most proud of is something called the OMT events. And these are the offsite events that we've created. So these cafes and various dinners and all of the informal gatherings that happen outside of the primary conference. And the reason we started these is because we recognize that a lot of senior people in the field, when they attend Academy, their calendars are booked with dinners and cafe meetings with people they already know. But when people are newer to the Academy, the formal program is their core thing that they're attached to, and they don't actually have the opportunity to have that casual coffee chat about a research topic. And we wanted to replicate that and start to basically share that with newer members of the division and of the Academy more broadly. And so now we have a new position that got started a few years ago that Emily Block is running, which is basically the membership chair. And in that role, she's running this entire series of off-program events. So it's everything from going and sitting in a cafe talking about a particular theory, or meeting editors of a journal in a casual cafe, to going out for a meal at an ethnic restaurant, or whatever it may be. And it's just an opportunity for people to start building those collaborative relationships with people outside of the formal sitting in a classroom or sitting in a conference center room, listening to four people present for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed that very much. I was at the Academy last year, and these events were great for meeting new people and networking. So do you have any advice for younger scholars that are thinking of going to the academy and are thinking of joining OMT?
They should. Is that too direct? Okay. No, for a new member or a newer member, even if it's not their very first academy, I do encourage them to take a look at those OMT off-program events because they're very low barrier in terms of access. And as well, look at some of our formal events too, if they're appropriate for the various career stages. So if they're a doctoral student that's at the dissertation proposal stage, think about the dissertation proposal workshop. If they're a slightly more advanced doctoral student, think about the doctoral student consortia. If they're a junior faculty member, the junior faculty consortia. If they're a very brand new first-time member who doesn't know where to go at all, come to the new member session that we have on Friday evening. Those types of things. And come to the socials and introduce yourself. And sometimes it's hard to introduce yourself, but the OMTers generally are responsive if you just say hello and start talking.
That's very true. In my experience last year, all the OMTers were very friendly and very open. So I can just confirm that. Just come and introduce yourselves. That brings us to the end of the formal part of this conversation. Thank you very much. But I would like to conclude with a quick lightning round of questions. So just answer with the first thing that comes to mind, basically.
Okay.
Reading, print or digital?
Digital.
What's the favorite part of your job?
Learning.
What's your least favorite part of your job?
That's a really good question. I like most of the aspects of the job. I think maybe grading.
I've heard that a few times during these recordings. What's the best way to handle stress?
Relationships.
In what sense?
All. So personal relationships and professional relationships, depending on the type of stress.
That coincidentally leads right into the next question. In terms of dating, would you recommend academic or non-academic?
That's totally up to the individual. They just have to find somebody who understands them.
Okay. And finally, if you could change one thing about academia, what would that be?
Ideally, it would be reducing the instrumental behavior, which has been sneaking into the field lately, and getting back to the core of academia, focusing on ideas that actually solve problems in society instead of just counting publications. That's the biggest one. And that if we can get that changed, and we're working hard to try to get that changed, there's a bright future ahead.
That concludes this conversation. Thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all for today. Thank you for listening. OMT Podcast is a community resource, so please feel free to get in touch with any questions, comments, or feedback that you might have. If you know someone from OMT who you think should be featured on this show, or you would like to come on and tell your own story and what you are working on, please get in touch with us on Twitter, Facebook, or the website. I hope to see you back for a new episode in 2 weeks' time. Goodbye.